Welcome to the 11th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobia. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hey, guys.
And also joining us tonight is regular crew member Lester Crow and his strolling bones.
Hello.
Welcome, everyone. So here we are, 11th episode, coming back at you. Should be a fairly quick episode that we've got here. We'll try and keep it around 1 hour. We're going to break things down with our system spotlight, go into healing. So last time around in the system spotlight, we talked about wounds and damage. This time we're going to talk about how to get rid of it. And then our main topic is going to be about creatures, and that's going to cover both the mechanics of the creatures as well as using them in role playing. And then, of course, we got questions and answers from you guys, but we're going to kick things off with the news. And I think the big news that we've got is actually something that came out today. We're recording on Thursday tonight. And Fantasy Flight has brought out another teaser for Blackfire Pass, all about the rune magic.
You know, this one was interesting because there wasn't a whole lot. It was actually, well, I guess teased is the key word, because there wasn't a whole lot that was actually revealed. They talked a little bit more about game design and development techniques and things they have to look out for while doing it, specifically this kind of rules bloat concept. But then they also went in a little bit to tease the basic mechanics of how the runesmithing will work.
Yeah, I'm happy to see them respond to that stuff directly. I mean, I know I've said before in previous episodes, that's my biggest concern, because they've got these cool ideas with the cards and the mechanics and all that kind of stuff. And I've always been concerned that they, you know, well, let's just do another card. Let's just throw in another mechanic. And having them explicitly say, well, let's make these new things like existing mechanics, is good. And they specifically mentioned what I was very happy about with Omens of War, the severe injuries just being treated just as a critical wound plus, as opposed to a different type of card or a different type of system.
So what it looks like they're doing is they're going to take the runes that get inscribed onto an item, and they're going to operate very similar to existing talent cards. So they're going to sock it essentially onto an item, and the item can be armor, weapon, mug of ale or necklace or really whatever you want. And they even provide some rules for different types of rune categories, a la the armor, weapon, and talisman categories.
And that kind of goes into the PDF that they included, some of the fluff there to talk about the rules around runes. Did you get into that, Lester? What did you think of that?
I thought it was pretty interesting how they touched on both mechanically and kind of story-wise how these runes are kind of treated in the world. They talked about like a rule of three, I believe, where a character cannot be benefiting from more than three runes within a specific category is how I interpreted that, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure. So like, well, I interpret it like you could have three on a weapon, three on armor, and three as talismans, but I'm not sure if that's actually how it works.
Yeah, that's what they talked about, and then they also gated it towards your career. So if you're an apprentice runesmith, you can only strike a single rune onto an item. If you're a regular runesmith, you know, the advanced career of that, you can strike two runes onto the item, and then beyond whatever's going to be in Blackfire Pass, the rune lord or, you know, the advanced skill, that's when, and plus fancy things like Anvils of Doom or stuff like that allows you to strike three runes onto an item.
Yeah, the three runes was GM, at the GM's discretion. But they you need to be rank one to do one rune, rank two to do two runes. They didn't say you need to be rank three to do three runes, but I think it's almost assumed that you're going to need to be pretty hardcore and have the GM's blessing. In the last paragraph, they started to talk about how many runes you can kind of have on your person at any given time. And I was a little unclear. Are you able to have, like, three runes on an axe, three runes on an armor, and three runes on a talisman? Or is it three runes total that you have equipped at a time?
You know, what it looks like to me reading that paragraph there is that you can have up to three runes on a weapon, because you can really only use one weapon at a time. You can have up to three runes on your armor, because you can only really use, you know, one piece of armor at a time, or one suit of armor at a time. But you can only have a maximum of three runes for your talismans. So you can have one talisman with three runes on it, or three talismans with one rune on it.
Oh, that was specifically directed towards talismans.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes a little more sense.
That's how I interpret it.
So it's not three runes runes for your helmet, three runes for your greaves, three runes for your breastplate. It's three runes for your armor set that you're wearing, right?
That's kind of how I took it. You know, up to three runes for your weapon, up to three runes for your armor, up to three runes for your talismans.
But they also hinted that there wasn't going to be very many runes in the expansion. They said a small number. So, you know, maybe what, four or five or six?
I'd bet five or six.
I mean, that sounds about right, but it also, I would have kind of hoped maybe for a little bit more there.
Well, I mean, what all can they really do with weapons they've got? They showed cleaving in the
plus two. Yeah, plus two piercing, which I think reduces the soak value of your opponent.
Armor. Yeah.
Precisely. And then like, I mean, really, they can only I can't see more than four per category, so more than 12 runes seems a little strange. Plus, it looked as though, oh no, or was that the engineering that had that quirky card that looked like you put little dice into it on the original?
That was the
Blackfire Pass release.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the inventions.
That makes sense. I always get confused with these expansions because they only tease with such small amounts of content.
Yeah. Well, it looks like they're gonna, I think we went 3 weeks for information on this, on this time, didn't we? Maybe even four?
Yeah. They've been, if you follow like Fantasy Flight's Twitter, they've been pimping a lot of their other products lately. So, I think just in their PR cycles, you know, Warhammer may have gotten bumped last week, so.
And they say at the end of that article too that it's what, a few months away is what they say, so that leads me to believe that sometime in August maybe is when we'll see Blackfire Pass.
Yeah, August or September probably, yeah.
You know, I think that still falls in line with the release schedule they put out early this year, the Sifting Through Shadows document. That's about right. They're still on track there.
I have a feeling they'll actually do another video, like have Jay Little do another video about the upcoming products that we can expect in the next year to come as well.
When is Gen Con? Isn't that summertime? Isn't that July?
I think that's in August or late July, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I think the other thing that we've got is, Jesse, you attended KublaCon last weekend.
I did, yeah. 3 days of gaming debauchery. It was fun. It was lots
cool.
of fun.
Did you get much Warhammering in?
You know, I did. I brought my whole duffel bag full of Warhammer stuff and introduced a few people who had never played third edition, who had only played like the tabletop war games, to it, and we had a great time. We ran through A Day Late and a Shilling Short, slightly modified version of that. I also got to meet up with, several of the, Fantasy Flight Forum members. Specifically, I got to meet up with, Epic Gamer Geek, Doc the Weasel, Gully Foyle, and Shun. Doc, Epic, and, Gully Foyle, the three of us, we played an accelerated version of Omens of War and had a really good time doing that on one of the days, and then also got chances to kind of hang out with them and have some fun. But one neat thing on Sunday, the Shun, he ran a Dark Heresy themed or Warhammer 40,000 themed game using the Warhammer 3rd edition rules. So he did a game called Akilla Down, which was kind of Black Hawk Down-esque, mission, you know, where our drop pod gets shot down and, you know, anyway, kind of went from there. But it was fun because the rule system, he made a couple custom cards, tweaked the careers to kind of fit 40K, had to add a couple new action cards, but the system worked really well for it. So that was a very creative way to see that come about. So anybody who is interested in that, you know, try and track down Shun, S-C-H-O-O-N, I believe was how it's spelled, on the Fantasy Flight Farms.
Very cool.
But otherwise, it was fun. Yeah, it was about three full days of gaming all night, all day and all night. So, cool. I certainly needed a day to recover after that.
Yeah, I haven't had much of a chance to go to gaming conventions. Living where I do, Comic-Con's a big thing around here, and I did a couple years of that, but not quite as much gaming in that, more general pop culture type stuff. But I've always thought about going to Gen Con, about doing that whole scene, so. But there are other cons around too. I should get off my butt and go see one, so.
Well, Conan the Barbarian is, trying to drag me to a few other in the Bay Area later on this year, so I'm excited to give those a shot, because I have I don't remember what they're called now, but we'll probably do a few more cons, we'll try and do some live sessions there, maybe expand some podcast stuff.
So I gotta ask you, I'm thinking about, maybe doing a demo game at my friendly local gaming store, but the thing that freaks me out a little bit is losing components. Somebody walking away with a souvenir. You got it? Did you have any concerns about that, or was that?
You know, I didn't. I just kind of went for it. I mean, I think I had the built-in safety margin of them not being completely total strangers, because they were other guys from the forums who we'd talked with a bunch of times already. So right. there was, I guess, on some level, a built-in level of trust there. And they all ended up being, really, really nice guys too. Which is fun. So I didn't do any games with strangers.
Oh, okay. I thought you did some new guy demos.
I did, but those were actually some other guys who I had known previously who had seen me bring. They were the guys I was staying with at the hotel room. And we had about six guys packed into that hotel room. So that was a sight to behold. With six gaming guys with all their gaming gear in a two-bed hotel room. We kept the privacy thing on the door the entire time. We didn't even want the poor maids to come in and see the disaster that we had left that room in. And this is a 4-star hotel too, so it was pretty funny.
That's good. Well, cool. Glad you had that time. Anybody else out there, if you've had con experiences or even a Warhammer Fantasy roleplay at a con, drop us a line. Let us know how it turned out and what you thought about it, or local game demos at your game store. Love to hear about that. See about people getting the word out about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition.
One final note on that. One thing I was surprised was that there were no games of the 2,000 registered games that were to be played over the weekend. None of them were Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 2nd or 3rd Edition. But, me bringing around the content, talking about it, there were loads and loads of people who were really interested to see it, or like, oh, hey, I've seen that. I've been wanting to play, or I heard all these misconceptions and this, that, and the other. So people still haven't quite, grasped on and taken it. But
yeah, it's pretty esoteric, eh?
One of the other things I forgot to mention as well is, I got a chance, is a quick plug for these other guys I met, the Independent Characters podcast is a Warhammer 40,000 podcast, but we ended up, our group ended up going out to dinner with them one of the nights, and we ended up just talking podcast talk and gaming talk in general, but we got a chance to talk a whole bunch about 3rd Edition and, which woes, and it's good stuff. And they were all big fans of 2nd Edition. And I was able to convert most of them into giving 3rd Edition a shot. So that should be pretty fun. But any of you guys out there who are interested in 40K, the Independent Characters podcast, those guys over there, Carl Tuttle and Geoff Hummel, are real fun guys.
Nice. And, just to plug ourselves here, if you can go back into the archives, we might have dropped off of iTunes, but you can definitely get it off of the website. Episode 2, we break down all those misconceptions about Warhammer 3rd Edition. So, send that off to your friends. Have them give a listen to it if you're trying to convince somebody that, this actually is a role-playing game and a pretty darn fun one, too. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll do it for the news. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll do the system spotlight all about healing. And we're back. So for the system spotlight, this is a regular segment that we do in all of our podcasts to dig into the mechanics of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, because there are a lot of unique mechanics in the game. This time around, we're going to talk about healing. Last time, in honor of Omens of War, that we had a system spotlight, we talked about damage. This time around, we're going to talk about how you remove that damage. So the important thing here is that it's very closely linked with the types of physical damage that you get. So there's the normal wounds that we've talked about before, which act a lot like hit points. Once you reach a certain number of normal wounds equal to your threshold, you pass out, you're knocked out. But then there's also the critical wounds that are counted as well. And again, unlike second edition, in third edition, you can get critical wounds. Your first wound could be a critical wound. It's not once you get down to zero normal wounds, you start taking critical wounds. So that kind of counts as the level of injury for you as a character. You can either have no wounds or you can be lightly wounded. And if you're lightly wounded, that means you only have normal wounds that you've taken. But if you have any normal wounds and critical wounds, then you're counted as critically wounded. And what that does is it sets up the difficulty, basically, for recovery of any of your wounds, either light or critical. The baseline is that if you're lightly wounded, it's an easy check, either against medicine or first aid or your resilience, which is one challenge die. But if you're critically wounded, then it's a normal check with two challenge dice. So the important thing to remember is the golden rule that was explicitly listed in the player's guide, which is you can only benefit from one source of healing per day. So there's multiple ways to be naturally healed. There's basically first aid, medicine checks, and then rest and recovery checks, either that or long-term care. Each one of those you can only benefit from them once. So if they try a first aid check and it fails, you can try again and keep trying until it succeeds. But only once per day can you recover wounds from a first aid check. Only once per day can you recover wounds from a medicine check. And only once per day can you recover wounds from magic, Shalion magic and some other magic, primarily on the faith side, also recovers from wounds.
So just for kicks, how do you like to play that when you're having multiple sessions that all happen during the same day in game terms? You might have three sessions that all take place during a 24-hour period. Do you, do you allow one healing per session, or do you restrict it out for the game day?
One per day. Warhammer is grim and perilous.
There you go. I have a problem with that. I just kind of wanted to throw it out there because that might be a house rule that different people handle a little differently.
Yeah, I thought you could actually use Shalion magic more than once to heal somebody up. Like, she can use her spell cards or whatever to, like a Shalion priestess to actually heal you multiple times within the same session, as long as she can meet the requirements for casting the spell or for invoking the blessing.
Well, there are multiple Shalion magics that can recover wounds.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be affected by more than one spell type per day. But the way that the rules are written is that, that one, I don't have any of them in front of me, so that one spell that the Shalion priestess casts, that's it. Once that spell is cast on you, once that blessing is cast on you, and you recover wounds, it's until the next day before that spell will affect you again. You can use the two different spells if you want to. So if the Shalion priestess has two or more different spells that recover wounds, then you can chain those. But it's one source. You can benefit from one source of healing. You can benefit from a source of healing only once per day.
Okay, and that includes the healing draughts, right? Or drafts, I mean.
I think so. Yeah.
Pretty sure you can only have one of those per day.
Yep.
Which I like, because then that takes away from the reliance on potion healing. It makes it feel less like Diablo and more, like you said, more grim and perilous.
And really, because of the way that time is kept or not kept in Warhammer Fantasy III, the story mode, how do you start getting into, if you've got the Shalion priestess how do you recover your curry favor over time, and how does recharge happen? And you could just chain those spells all day long if you're in story mode. So being able to make that hard limitation that says, you know, just once a day, really kind of avoids you from your rules lawyers, I guess, from really overusing that and really getting yourself back up to full health, you know, as long as there's a break in the action.
Do you feel that kind of defeats the purpose of playing a Shalyan priest, that if you can't actually go in there and keep your party healed?
Well, you can cast your spell on every single party member. You can.
I mean, you can cast spells, but I mean, like, you know, let's just say, if there's a cleric in the party on D&D, odds are between encounters, everybody's going to get fully healed to some degree. Maybe that's an oversimplification, but I'm not against the way they have it. I'm just kind of wondering, from your guys' perspective, do you feel that the restriction on healing, especially since it affects casters as well, do you think that reduces their effectiveness? Because like a bright wizard can cast his fireballs as often as he likes, but the healer can only cast his a limited number of times.
Well, he can cast it as many times as he likes. It can only affect a person once a day, right? A particular person once a day.
Right. So then I'm just thinking, you know, okay, I'm playing a game where there's multiple sessions. So maybe there's three game sessions that take place during one day, and I'm seeing that my spell library will not get as much use as maybe another type would.
I think if you go down, though, I think if you actually look at what the Shalyans can do,
you gotta kind of make sure that you have a nice wide range of spells available.
Well, and there aren't very many that actually heal. I see that the calming touch does healing of actual wounds. What else am I looking at?
Okay, so most of the other ones.
There's a cure wounds, and there's a cure critical wounds. So there's basically one spell per rank that the Shalyans use for straight up wound healing.
Yeah, the rest of it has to do with like diseases or getting rid of fatigue and stress and in other ways allaying penalties to players.
Right, right. Yeah, there's different ways of buffing them, exactly, against disease, fatigue and stress, yeah, recovering insanity, all of those sorts of things. So really, you know, you're looking at basically a single spell per rank, right? So it's rank one is calming touch, rank two is cure wounds, and rank three is cure critical wounds. So those are really the only ones that are affected by this healing rule.
But there's all sorts of other ways to die or become infirm in the world of Warhammer, right? Not just wounds.
For sure.
So the Shalyan priestess does have actually quite a bit of utility, with that limitation.
So the first aid checks were kind of the more straightforward healing that any other character might do, separate from magic. How does that work?
So immediate care in the thick of battle. If you're in encounter mode, you can use first aid. You know, characters who have the first aid skill, which I believe is an advanced skill, readied, can use first aid on people. First aid can only remove normal wounds. So what you do is you make a first aid check against the level of injury difficulty, right? One die if it's light, two dice if it's critical. You do a first aid on a character, and then you get, for the number of successes that you get on that test, is the number of normal wounds that are healed up to a person's toughness, up to the character's toughness. So it's usually going to be 3, 4, or 5 max. Or you can use first aid to ignore a critical wound, not heal a critical wound, but ignore a critical wound severity, if you're able to get the number of successes equal to the severity of that wound. And then that wound is it doesn't count, basically. It's the card is marked or turned over until the next day.
It still counts as a wound. It just doesn't count as, like, its critical effect does not come into play.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the critical effect doesn't come into play. And since it's battlefield dressing, since you're doing it in the middle of combat, if you fail and you get two banes, then the person who you've tried to heal, you actually harm. You give them a stress and fatigue, and if they're critically wounded, while you're messing around in there, you actually damage them some more, and they get a normal wound on top of what they've got.
I think that's awesome.
That's funny.
So that's the battlefield care. That's during combat. When you're out of combat, then there's the natural healing that you have, which is basically after a night's rest, you regain wounds and you make a resilience check. So if you get a normal night's rest, you regain the number of normal wounds equal to your toughness, so usually 3, 4, or 5. No check for that, just automatically, boom, you get those number of normal wounds back. But in addition, you make a resilience check versus your injury level. So one die for light, 2 dice for critical again. And that resilience check is actually a little bit inverted. The number of successes on the resilience check is the severity of critical wounds that you can heal. The number of boons is actually the number of normal wounds that you heal.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually backwards from what I thought it was, but
okay. Yep. Yeah, it's because boons are a little bit rarer actually than successes. Getting rid of your critical wounds, as long as you get the right number of successes, can be done through natural healing. Mm-hmm. And then of course you get, if you have assistance by somebody with first aid, then they can make a first aid check, and for every, this doesn't provide healing, right? So the first aid check, they could do a first aid check for you to do battlefield dressing, and then they could do another first aid check for your rest and recovery. Because that first aid check, then for every success, it adds a fortune die to your resilience check. And it adds another fortune die if you get 2 or more boons on that. Did that make sense? Did I lose you guys there?
That very last part.
No, it makes
part,
sense. It makes sense to me.
Yeah,
well,
so
you're much smarter than I am.
It's because we're Canadian.
So I'll use the same example. The same thing can be done with a person with a medicine check. So if a person has medicine, then they can assist your resilience check. By doing the medicine check, it adds dice to the dice pool of the resilience check.
Okay.
So since the medicine check does not heal you directly, it just modifies your dice pool, then that can be done on top of another medicine check that directly helps you, basically.
So is a medicine check the same as an immediate care, like first aid?
The medicine checks primarily are done either for rest and recovery or long-term care.
Okay.
It takes too much concentration to be able to do it in an immediate sense. Like on the battlefield, you're not allowed to use it.
So the other neat thing I was thinking is with the resilience check, when you're doing rest and recovery, you can adjust the difficulty. I'm sorry, not the difficulty, but the add some fortune and misfortune dice based on the quality level of where you're getting your rest and recovery. If it's a beautiful hotel or an inn that's and you're being fed and it's warm and dry, maybe you'll add a fortune die or two to the roll. But if you're outside in the dirt, if it's raining, if you're in a cave, you might be adding misfortune dice to that rest and recovery roll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So just to close the loop on that, though, the medicine assistance gives you an expertise die if you succeed with the check at all. And if you get 2 or more boons on that check, then you get another expertise die on top of it. So that can really, once you throw that expertise die in there, you start getting some righteous successes, and you can get rid of some critical wounds pretty quickly.
So what you're saying is you'll make that medicine check before the resilience check is made, and the medicine check determines how many extra dice are going to be added to your resilience check.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's not combined into one roll. They're actually 2 separate rolls.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. It's just but think about it like even just somebody giving you a suggestion on, eat this food because it's good, or they prep your bandages for you or whatever. They're just aiding you in your recovery. They're not, they're not actually providing you any sort of, direct physical repair. Like they're not in there stitching it up for you, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it.
Yeah. So then the one last thing about rest and recovery is that if you're assisting yourself, right? So if you're trained in first aid and you're trying to assist your own rest and recovery or medicine, then you add 1 challenge die to the test. So to your resilience check, actually. So you may gain an expertise die because you're trained in medicine, but since you're trying to fix yourself or work on yourself, then you do, then it does go up, the challenge of that resilience check goes up one die.
Yeah, it's hard to repair yourself when your entrails are spilling out.
but there's no disadvantages to doing the rest and recovery check, the resilience check. If you fail the check, that just means that you don't get any wounds back. You're not going to hurt yourself anymore. And then the third type of care is long-term care. So that's where you've done nothing all day but take care of yourself, whether it's in an inn or a chalet in a hospice or something like that. And the only difference between the rest and recovery, you still get one resilience check a day. The only difference between the long-term care and the rest and recovery is that your difficulty is always reduced by one. So if you're lightly wounded, then you just get zero. It's a simple check. And then if anybody with medicine is assisting you, it's automatically plus one expertise die. And then you can determine what you want to use the successes of your resilience roll for. You can either put them towards normal wounds or put them against the severity of your critical wounds.
So you don't get the benefits of boons, though, during long-term care, only successes.
No. It's just successes, and you pick one or the other. Mm-hmm. You're either healing your normal wounds or you're healing your criticals.
Okay.
But you always get the benefit of recovering normal wounds equal to your toughness per day of rest, right?
Yep, straight up. Yep, that's always going to happen. So, you know, having the resilience check during the regular rest and recovery, having the boons equal your normal wounds, and usually you get less boons than you get successes on a roll, that kind of makes sense because you're adding on that number of toughness, the number of wounds that you're, normal wounds that you're recovering through your toughness as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of balances out. And then last thing is the healing draft, right? So that's basically, it kind of counts as a rest and recovery check, except for it's just for fortune dice. So any boons on the four fortune dice are normal wounds, and then successes, equals the number of successes can cancel out a critical wound.
And then a high quality healing draft and a low quality healing draft will either add one white die or remove one white die from that roll.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a character who plays a hunter and took first aid skills and nature lore skills, and they made a really good argument that they should be able to put together some sort of poultice or whatever, however you call that, to repair it themselves. So I use the rules for healing drafts, for inferior quality healing drafts, and they can spend time to create these things to get three fortune dice to try to heal themselves.
The descriptions of healing poultices in second edition were fantastic. It's like these muddy, you know, they just smell like feces, and you just
stinking,
like, yeah, you just like apply them in this like pasty mold onto your wound and let it sit there. And, it just, you could imagine it'd be horrible.
The application of maggots.
Yeah.
Yeah, leeches, hey?
So that pretty much covers healing. It can get a little complex. You know, you've got that immediate care, rest and recovery versus long-term care. But if you've got, you know, write yourself down some quick notes or something like that, should be easy to pretty quickly reference. And once you do that a couple of times, which you probably will because you're going to get hurt a lot in Warhammer, you'll get it down pretty quick. So I think we'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about the bad guys and the creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back. So our main topic tonight is going to be all about the bad guys, the creatures. And I want to kick things off by digging into the creature cards. So when the Guides and Vaults came out towards the beginning of this year, very excited about the inclusion of creature cards, the ability to reference the bad guys all on one regular playing sized card. It's really, in my mind, out of all the guides and vaults, the creature vault is the must have out of that set.
It's easily my favorite.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and, for sure.
And everything since then has included all of the creatures as creature cards as well. So Omens of War, you get all the creature cards that are mentioned, all of the corn dogs and bloodletters and bloodthirsters. I just had to throw corn dogs in there because that was, like saying corn dogs. You know, those are all included in there. Witch's Song has all of those creatures, included as cards as well. And it's a really great reference. It's a really great way as a GM to kind of keep track of, what bad guys you've got out in the particular encounter. So let me just run down what's on the creature card. So first it starts off in the upper left-hand corner is the creature's threat rating. Now, this is something a little bit like Dungeons & Dragons where they do challenge level, stuff like that, but they're very explicit about how the number of skulls in this threat rating does not translate into a PC of rank 1, rank 2, rank 3. They are referencing each other. So a creature with a 4 threat is going to be more powerful than a creature with a 3 threat, which is going to be a lot less powerful than a creature with a 10 threat. Whether or not your party can survive an encounter with one of those creatures, don't know. And they're not necessarily saying whether you can or not. So there is a little bit as a GM, you know, understanding where your party is and what they can handle in terms of threat level is a little bit of an art.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they've got the traits that they have or the categories that they have. So you've got your green skins, your undead, your skaven, and that actually ties back to the group sheets that you use, which were included also in the creature's vault. You've got your wound threshold, which is there, and then your stat block. So it breaks down the strength, toughness, agility, intelligence, willpower, and fellowship. And then it breaks out, instead of putting it in line as they've done in the books before, it actually breaks out with separate icons your damage values, your soak value, and your defense. Yeah. So it's very easy to see, alright, if this guy does a melee attack, I take his strength, I take his damage value, that's the damage that he's doing. You know, if he's taking hits, I take his toughness, I take his soak value, that's the damage reduction that occurs. It's very simple. These creature cards and the way that they lay out these creatures is that all the information that you need to run them in a battle or an encounter is right there. So you can change things around if you want to. If you want to give them specific weapons or abilities or stuff like that, there's the possibility for you to do that, but you don't have to. You don't have to figure out, all right, well, this guy's got a sword, and this guy's got an axe, and this guy's got a great sword. It's all just kind of inferred by that damage rating value. And then the armor that they have and their defensive abilities are assumed by the soak value and the defense value that they have.
So if you want to take one of those creatures and make him a little harder or a little easier, all you really do is just kind of bump a number up or down or add a fortune or misfortune dice here, and you're pretty much good to go. You don't need to go and make a new custom character card for that, gore that's just a little bit weaker than the stock one.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I had a question on those cards. They do have a built-in suggested stance. So, you know, R2, for example, which would be 2 in the reckless. Are you, able to adjust that, or are your creatures just kind of stuck into that stance that's on the card?
Rules as written, creatures, so that's actually something we were going to dig into later on, the three classes of creatures, right? You've got, henchman level creatures, you've got normal creatures, and you've got nemesis level creatures. So any of these creatures can be a henchman, a normal, or a nemesis level. Although a nemesis snotling would be pretty interesting. Anyway, normals and henchmen, in the rules as written, they're stuck in that stance. They don't move stance at all. They are, you know, a black orc is always going to be R2. That's it, nothing else. Nemesis level creatures can change their stance.
So a nemesis is the equivalent of a PC character just in bad guy form.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. So you should have if you're having a nemesis character, you should be of a similar level of detail. You're probably not operating on a creature card at that point, for your nemesis. That should be a reoccurring character where you have a little bit more data to log their critical wounds, their inventory, their name, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. But again, just to give you what you need and not to overburden you with a lot of tracking as a GM, for the normal and the henchman level, creatures, that's it. Their stances right there. Now they do get a little fancy with it because sometimes you see two stances with a slash in between them. Specifically around Zinch or high-level creatures, and that means that you can pick one or the other. So they could go conservative or reckless. And then the really rare creatures actually have a plus between the two stances, and that means they can do both.
Yeah.
So you can actually roll an attack that has both conservative and reckless dice in it at the same time, which makes for some interesting results.
So the henchmen... I know we didn't really get into the ACE statistics yet, but henchmen are generally the weakest of a creature type and tend to get bucketed together into a single creature element when you're playing the game. So you might have five or six Ungor be represented by a single Ungor token, and they kind of move around in a mob.
Right. So that's the idea. The henchman concept is the idea of glomming together weaker creatures and have them act in terms of tracking and combat as a single creature. And usually what you do is you use, henchman groups are the number of party characters that you have. Mm-hmm. So if you have a party of four, then the Ungors are going to group up into groups of four each.
With four of them.
Yeah. And the way that...
And how is it that you determine their wounds again?
So the rules for henchmen are is that their wounds is their toughness times the number of people in there. So if you've got four Ungors, then it's going to be, I believe, toughness for Gors or Ungors are four. So if you've got a group of four, then their wound threshold of that group is 16.
Now, what happens as you have essentially a group of four Ungor there with a combined wound threshold of 16. Let's say you do four wounds. Does that group get weaker, or do you have to knock out all 16 wounds and then just the whole group goes away?
No, it actually, well, it gets weaker because when the henchmen group works together, on their checks, they do checks as a normal creature type, but they add fortune dice equal to the number in their group, right? Mm-hmm. So if that group of four Ungor attacks you, they're going to roll as one Ungor, but add another three fortune dice to it.
So once they have 12 wounds remaining, are they to be considered three Ungor?
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, exactly. Yeah. And wounds from a single hit transfers across, so you can kill one and a half Ungor with one blow if you do
right.
If you do 6 points of damage, say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Super.
So they work.
The normal creatures are pretty much creature card as written.
Right.
And typically you don't fight dozens of creature cards as written. Typically you'll fight a handful of creature cards as written, and then a group or two of henchmen in kind of a good size encounter.
Yeah, they're kind of the choir. I mean, it's the idea of being able to do a mass battle. You know, when you get Warhammer characters are relatively, especially the combat-oriented ones, are relatively powerful already. And you don't want to have to manage, you know, 15 goblins.
Well, this is instead, also why the creature vault or any of the supplements we have do not have 10 orcs and 10 goblin tokens for you to use. They only have one or two because they're meant to be used in these henchmen and normal combinations. You're meant to bucket them together.
Yeah. But the important thing with henchmen and normal creatures, the way that they take damage, is that normal creatures take critical wounds. And we talked about that back with the episode where we talked about damage. So you want to inflict those critical wounds because you can affect those big creatures right off the bat instead of, you know, chunking away to get down to zero. Mm-hmm. Henchmen groups do not get critical wounds. If a henchman group gets a critical wound, then when you flip the card over, you take the severity of that critical wound and added as normal wounds to the henchman group. So again, it's another thing that you don't have to track critical wounds for the henchman group or which henchman gets which critical wound, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, when you flip over a critical wound that has the X value, what does that translate to?
I think it depends on what the X value is.
No, but I mean, like, if you're applying these wounds to a henchman group, so you flip it over, you know, if it had a severity rating of 3, they take 3 additional wounds. Uh-huh. If it has a severity rating of X, those typically feed off of other critical wounds that already exist, but those critical wounds don't exist in the case of henchmen. So does that translate to 0 or 1
they
by
explode.
Default?
They just explode.
I'd probably redraw at that point. Okay. I'd flip over another card.
Yeah, what I had played.
You just have to quit the game. Now,
yeah, game over. What I had played up until now was just default that to 1 wound. But redrawing, I guess, is another good option.
Yeah, that's a good idea, though, to just count it as 1.
Because you always do 1 wound anyway when you do damage. So,
yeah.
You know,
exactly.
If you're a critical wound, you'll always do at least 1 extra wound.
Mm-hmm. And that's another important point. So henchman level and normal level creatures do not take stress or fatigue. If they ever take points of stress or fatigue, those are translated into normal wounds automatically. So if they want to do an extra maneuver, they take a wound. If they want to, I can't think of what else they do that would.
Well, they might nothing they can manually do, but you know they might roll a blood drop on their reckless dice and generate an extra fatigue point, or they may roll 2 banes.
Or a character may have an ability that causes fear, which will do direct damage to them. Nemesis level creatures, of course, do track stress and fear just like a PC.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you, I've always been kind of curious, how do you guys handle, when a henchman, or a normal, enemy takes stress or fatigue, which gets translated into wounds? How do you kind of explain that in game description? Like, goblin attacks you and rolls a blood drop. How do you translate that into, explaining it?
You know, from my perspective, I mean, you can say, you know, hey, if it's a goblin, I mean, they're pretty much comic relief anyway. So, you know, if he stabs himself or if he bashes himself on the head before he bashes you on the head, you know, that all kind of makes sense. So,
if it's a group of henchmen, one of them steps on the other guy's toe or whatever, you know, and they bash each other on the noggin before they overwhelm you, and you know.
You know what's funny is I've had a scenario where. The creature ended up killing itself with that fatigue, which became an awkward one to try and explain as well. Where like the goblin's running at you and then just kind of like winds himself and passes out on the ground.
He pulls his groin and he's done for the combat. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean he's dead, right? He just could be incapacitated from combat, because when you gain wounds equal to your wound threshold, you pass out and you're effectively not useful in combat anymore, correct? But you're not necessarily dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's explicit in the rules for the creatures. They're not dead, they're defeated. So they use that word specifically. So if they're knocked out, if they're rolling on the ground going ow, 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 you know, there's multiple ways. They're basically out of the fight at that point.
Yeah.
So to go back to the creature cards, two more things that are on there is that you've got the specific rule references for the specialization of that creature right there on the card. So you don't have to go back and look at the book to figure out that, you know, black orcs do we as big a rules or stomp the stunties rules or things like that. Those are all referenced there on the card, which is pretty cool. And then the last piece, or the second to last piece on the creature card, but is the additional icons that they allow for customized actions. So your stronger creatures are going to have other actions that you can pull out of the deck that are potentially above and beyond what the normal set of undead actions are or skaven actions are. So you'll have an extra sword or for melee, you know, fireball for spell, things like that, attached to these creatures, and it's good for NPCs as well, to add a little customization and flavor specifically to those guys.
Yeah, for sure. I like that a lot. I like the customization and, like, the mod ability of it. I'm still to this day pretty floored with the fluidity of the game and like how all the components and how the dice system and everything just, it makes the game experience. You would think that it would slow it down because of all the components, but as long as everybody knows how to use those components, it actually speeds it up significantly. But have you ever used, cards for creatures, even though they don't have, like the creature card doesn't specifically state that you should add an action card to this creature? Have you ever, like, say, taken a goblin card and added additional abilities to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that I see those action card option icons count is that those are the ones that are kind of outside of their creature type. So if I'm putting together, for example, a Skaven attack, you know, a Skaven encounter, I'll pull out the appropriate Skaven creature cards that I've got and then go through the creature action cards that are related to the Skaven and then pick out the ones that I think, you know, all right, the Gutter Runners should have these actions, the Storm Vermin should have these actions, and the Slaves should have these actions. Mm-hmm. Once I've kind of done that, then I'll go back and look at the action card options, and if, you know, the Gray Seer's got two extra spells, well, then I'll go to the entirety of the book, right, and, mm-hmm. and not just limit myself to the Skaven stuff, but go out to maybe some other shamanic magic, or even into the regular orders of magic, and pull a card from there and bring that in. So that's kind of how I see that those action card items is those are the special above and beyond what the normal set of actions are for that creature.
Yeah, I love the idea of having like a goblin who drinks alcohol and breathes fire. So giving him that fire breathing action card that came in the creature's vault. I've got this dastardly plan to create a goblin who does that in my next adventure that I get to play with my home group.
And that is one of the things with the action cards, you know, that we've talked about before where, you know, you don't have to limit, the action cards are not limited to a particular creature or creature type. You can mix and match if you want to. You can have the warp fire thrower be the dragon breath or a goblin with, you know, a fire breathing goblin because he's soused on fungus wine, you know, have fire breath as well. So yeah, don't feel that you have to limit yourselves to, you know, what's written in the book as the actions, quote unquote, of particular creatures.
Yeah, they actually explicitly say that too, though, right? Where they're like, where they say, you know, don't let these traits be limiting to you. If you find a use for them outside of what they're, how they're written, feel free. You know, I really like that about the game in general.
So the last thing I want to talk about with creatures is the aggression, cunning, and expertise dice. So, especially for your normal and your henchman level creatures and even your nemesis level creatures, you don't necessarily have to track which skills they know or which special abilities, feats, and talents that they have. Instead, that is all included in this aggression, cunning, and expertise dice budget. So you gain a certain number of dice for aggression, which is all physical actions. All right. So if you are doing an attack, and basically what these dice are used is they're used as GM's fiat to modify dice pools, either offensively or defensively. Mm-hmm. So it's basically you spend aggression to add white or black dice to a physical dice pool that affects the creature or that the
and
creature
this is per token based, right? So the if it's either every group of henchmen gets their own pool, every gore gets his own pool, every nemesis, everything.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So the aggression is for the physical, the cunning is for the mental. Things like if you want to take an extra, and there's actually quite a few house rules that are out there for the creatures as well to use, like, you can spend a die from aggression to do an extra maneuver without taking fatigue. Or you can, actually use cunning to change the stance temporarily for that one turn. Those are some of the optional rules, some of those optional rules that are out there as well. But primarily they can be used for offense. So if the orc wants to go all in on a strike, then he can spend aggression dice to add fortune dice to that one blow without having to use an action card or anything like that. Or defensively, again, if they're getting a hit, they can spend aggression dice to add basically misfortune dice to an attacker's role as well. So it's very helpful to kind of, instead of making it the same thing each time, you know, I whack you, you whack me, this is going to work this way, this is going to work that way, you can kind of change it up a little bit by spending these dice.
Mm-hmm. I really like them.
And then the expertise dice, the fun thing about them is that they count as expertise dice in the rolls. So the ability for the black orc to do that huge strike that actually adds one of the yellow dice to their attack, you know, they can do that twice basically in an encounter. So that's the really powerful part that they're able to do.
And now one question is on the creature's turn, every turn, can they only use one of these dice, or can you use the entire pool of aggression dice and both of the expertise dice in one epic attack?
I don't see anything in the rules that limits the amount that you can use, with the understanding that once you use it, it's gone.
Yeah, it's done.
Yeah. I mean, there are some special abilities, and I think there's some rally abilities as well that allows you to refresh your pools, your ace pools, aggression, cunning, and expertise. But by and large, you know, once you use it, it's gone. And honestly, you know, depending on the level of encounter that you have, Warhammer battles don't last, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition battles, don't necessarily last that long. I mean, you're really only going 5, maybe 6, 7 rounds, depending on, you know, if you're fighting against these guys. So, I would definitely use them early and often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I like how combat's a lot more fluid than in a game of Dungeons and Dragons. I've played games of D&D where the entire session became bogged down in one single melee, and the melee wasn't even written into the adventure. It was just something that the players decided to get themselves into, and that just kind of like detracts from it. Whereas with Werfup, or whatever you want to call it, this game really lends to a more fluid experience. I really enjoy that.
And to be fair, I mean, a lot of focus on D&D 4th edition has been to streamline the combat and make it easier. But there's definitely, I mean, there's role-playing systems that are geared towards, you know, one-on-one combat, and then there's role-playing systems that are geared towards, you know, larger mass combat, and then there's, you know, why are you playing this game? Go play Warhammer Fantasy Battles for real, you know, level of combat. And I think, you know, with the difference between the henchmen and the normal creatures, and then having those special nemesis level creatures, it, you know, makes that nice balance of where are you caring about the one-on-one versus you're mowing through the hordes of goblins, you know, goblins or ungors.
Yeah, it's a great structure. I like it a lot.
So that's pretty much everything I've got on creatures. Anything else you guys want to add to it?
No, I'm good.
Okay, so we'll take our last break, and then when we come back, Jesse will run down some questions.
As always, you can submit your questions to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Joseph emails, since we can basically choose any action card we want, barring GM rules, why is it we can only train within those 5 skills listed on our career sheet during creation? I understand that someone would pick up the knack for their job as they do it, but don't you think there should be an option like spending 2 advances to train 1, like later on as your character advances?
I think he definitely makes a good point. You know, there really is, in the rules as written, there's no restrictions on which action cards you can take, but you are limited to the, to just those skills that are within your career. And as far as I remember, there isn't any way that you can train a skill that isn't listed within your career. But I think that's pretty important to make the careers unique. There really isn't a lot mechanically in terms of differences between the career other than the skills that you have available to you, the talent slots that you get, and then the advancement scheme that's shown. So there's not a lot of skills in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, and some of them are pretty darn important. I mean, the number of times that you need to use resilience in this game, if you're taking damage or disease or recovery or corruption or things like that, is huge. So, you know, that's really one of the reasons mechanically, not in the game, role-playingly, why you would switch to a particular career, because it has those skills that you want and you need. And switching between careers is not that big of a deal. I mean, it's anywhere from zero if you're a Reichlander, you know, up to four advances to do that.
Mm-hmm. I was under the impression that you could train outside skills after character creation by spending an additional advancement point to what it would normally cost you. As a GM, I did add my own little house rule there where at character creation, if you had a good enough story and you spent the additional advances, then you could definitely train something outside. But I do like what you say there. And you pointed out, Paul, in another episode that it's actually more beneficial to train skills after character creation, because once you complete a career, you get the free specialization if you spend your, the dedication bonus. But you only get those on things that you trained during play, not during character creation. I've actually changed the way that I design characters now because of how you pointed that out. Normally I would take a bunch of skills at first level, but it actually seems to be a better plan to, as you advance, learn the skills.
Super. So Steven emails, the FAQ says the fixed advances don't count towards your advances options. So if I'm a thief and there are 3 skill advances, does that mean I can in total take 4 skill advances, 3 based off my advanced options, and 1 because of my fixed advances?
Yeah, I believe that is correct. Yeah. So
yes. That is the answer to that question.
So also with that thief, if I take a non-career advance, that would count for 1 of my 3 skill advance options?
No, it doesn't. The non-career advances just count towards your 10. They don't count specifically towards wounds or talents or, stance or anything like that, actions.
They apply towards that open bucket of 3 or 4 at the end, right?
Right, there's actually 6, right? So you've got the 4 fixed. So you have an action, a talent, a skill, and a wound. So every career has those 4 advances. Then you have 6 that are open, and the maximum out of those 6 that you can take are listed in the advancement scheme on the front side of that, on the front side of that career package. If you take any non-career advances, then those are taken from your open. And that just means you have less open advances. But if you take, you know, if you take 4 or if you take 3 non-career advances, you can still spend your other 3 open advances on that skill and then your 4th fixed skill on the skill. So you can still have 4 skills and 3 open advances or 3 non-career advances.
And it's also very possible to spend more than 10 experience points while in a career before actually completing that career. You may be forced at some point to spend 12 or 13 experience points or advancement points to actually satisfy the requirements of that career, because you may be doing characteristic increases with some wasted points, or you may also be, you know, going into some advanced career or advanced skills that that may not be able to apply towards your career advancement.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure, and I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure everything that you do towards everything that you advance within that career counts either as your fixed, your open, or your non-career advances.
Right, but you may actually at some point fill up the available slots and still have more advances required to be spent in order to get that benefit.
But I'm pretty sure once you reach 10, you're done.
But if you haven't, like, let's say you've already spent 9 and you are, and you buy an advanced skill.
Yeah.
And the remaining one to be filled is an action card. That only gets satisfied by buying the action card. So you can be spending.
You're right. Yep.
Wasting them.
Yeah. The non-career advances don't count towards career completion. Right. So in order to complete the career, you have to do the four fixed and the 6 open career advances. Once you do those, then you spend an 11th advance to get your dedication bonus. And then beyond that, you're going to spend anywhere from 0 to 4, or potentially more to actually transition to a new career.
Mm-hmm. So Grayson writes in your podcast on magic and faith, between 40 minutes and 40 minutes, 45 seconds, you mentioned that purchasing piety during character creation, priest specifically, gives you curry favor automatically. Is that only for priest careers or other careers with access to piety? And does that mean that piety alone gives you favor equal to your equilibrium with or without curry favor?
Curry favor is only for priests. So it's explicit. So, I'm looking it up right here, but it's very specific in the character creation section of the, player's guide, page 39. There's a box that's got starting wizards and priests. So it specifically says starting priest characters called initiates do not receive the same free bonuses as wizards do. However, a newly created initiate character who begins the game with piety acquired or trained will also add the curry favor card to his action deck. So, unfortunately, yeah, if your zealot starts out with piety, the zealot isn't going to get curry favor.
Okay.
Curry favor is my understanding just for the priests.
So would a zealot career use piety and the favor and be able to use like a blessing, like penitent zeal? Because that only requires a piety check, not an invocation. So is it
But does it require favor?
I think yeah.
Yeah, I think all blessings require favor, right?
Right.
So even though it's a piety check, even though it's not an invocation, zealots are never going to have favor because they're never going to get curry favor because they're not priests. I mean, you can be a priest that's a zealot, but if you're a zealot, you're a zealot and not a priest.
Yeah, you're just insane. That's all that you are.
You can be insane and be a priest too. There's no problem with that. I mean, it's the difference between the career and the way that you play the character, I think.
Yeah. Well, you could be a priest and then transition be a priest, gain access to an insanity, go through the zealot career and become, what are those guys called? A flagellant if you wanted to and still have access to casting your blessings, right? Like if you go through the initiate career, you still have access to blessings. Even if you go out of that career and start being, say, a witch hunter, you can still cast those blessings. You just don't get access to your specific faith, your faith specific ability. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, that wraps it up for the Q&A, guys.
Cool. And I think that wraps it up for our episode as well. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Please, you know, visit us on the site, recklessdice.com. Send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, recklessdice. We're out there everywhere. And please check out our new Facebook site as well. We're looking at potentially putting out maybe a poll of the week out there and providing the answers to that on our next podcast. So check us out there. Thanks again for listening, and do drop us a review on iTunes as well. Again, we appreciate all the feedback out there from all the listeners, the good and the bad, because we want to make sure that we make this podcast the best Warhammer podcast out there and the most entertaining for you guys. So thanks a lot for listening again, and everybody have a good night.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night.